ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Hi, Selena Green here for you on this Friday. Hello. Well, a bit of a focus on trade first up today, particularly for South Australian exports into the USA and to China. We've got local producers in China right now at a massive trade show, and you're going to hear from one of them who's there. Also, a shipment of Australian canola is heading to China for the first time in years.
What we're hearing is that this is under a trial basis. So what that says to us is that we need to make sure that things are done very well and we don't get too far ahead of ourselves. But if the trial becomes successful, then hopefully that may lead to more market access if it comes to that.
A lot of news swirling around two of our biggest trading partners. We'll come to more on that shortly. And some good news later on for one part of our state that has finally stepped free of fruit fly restrictions. That's been a long journey. First up today, some new export figures from the state government are showing the growing volume of South Australian exports making their way into the United States, our second largest trading partner behind China. Of course, both those markets have been quite volatile ones for trade in recent times, with tariff wars seeing the goalposts shifting constantly. This week, the legality of wide-reaching US tariffs placed on dozens of countries, including Australia, is being debated in the US Supreme Court. And that decision by the court is expected to be handed down, well, the ruling possibly within weeks, which is quite a hurried process compared to how long it usually takes. Well, Joe Sokach is South Australia's Minister for Trade and Investment. He joins me now. Minister, thanks so much for joining us on the Country Hour.
Good afternoon, Simon. Really good to be with you.
You've got some recent ABS figures around South Australian exports to the United States. What trends are we seeing?
Yeah, look, we do. And really good news for South Australian producers, and not just producers, but innovators right across the state. And it tells a really positive story for the reputation that South Australia has right across the world, but particularly in the US. In the last 12 months, not only have we seen an increase in the exports of from South Australia to the US, but we've hit an all-time record high. And that's really pleasing, of course, as you said in your intro, in the context of these really disruptive tariffs that have been applied and this really disruptive world economic order. But, you know, one thing that we did as a government was we acted early. We didn't wait for these tariffs to start to flow through. We saw them, put up the flagpole for some time from the US administration. So we've brought that additional funding online through our state budget. We've been leading major and high-level trade missions, including by myself, into the US in the last number of months. And this is a good story for our producers, but of course the work remains, as it always is, ahead of us.
What's driven that growth when you break it down into commodities? What is the American market wanting from us?
Probably the story behind the story that pleases me the most is the diversified contribution that various commodities have made to that story. Meat is performing really well, and as I've spoken personally on your show before, Selena, that the US has a demand for red meat that they simply can't meet themselves. So our producers, both across the sheep and beef sectors, are doing really well. We're also seeing base commodities continuing to perform strongly, in that leads and coppers and some of those natural resources that our state holds. But I'm also really pleased to see wine increase by nearly 10%. You know, the US remains a really important market for our wine. It's also a really important market for a price point and a volume of wine that particularly is of focus and is of really high quality from regional communities, particularly the Riverland. So a 10% increase there in a really tough global wine market does tell a positive story. But again, when it comes to these global trends on wine, there is some serious headwinds that we're facing.
Yeah, and when we talk about China, they're being our major trade partner, and they've traditionally taken a lot of our wine. They're still taking a lot of it, but certainly not as much as they once were. So to have markets like the US taking more, I mean, is going to be critical, but it's not the full solution.
Look, it's not the full solution. What our efforts have been now for, you know, really the best part of the last 3 years with our wine export programs has been diversify. China remains the largest single buyer of our wine, nearly $750 million worth of South Australian wine into the market. But what we're seeing in every single jurisdiction around the world, including right here at home in Australia, is that people are drinking less wine, but they are drinking better wine. And we see that consumers, particularly in a growing middle class in Asia, are lifting or shifting in the price point of wines. So as we continue to support the access of South Australian wine into market, we also need to be working really closely with industry and, you know, whether it be Wine Australia or the South Australian Wine Industry Association right here at home, to continue to meet demands for varietals or quality of wine that the world is going to be demanding, not just today, but, you know, next week, next month and next year.
Speaking with the South Australian Minister for Trade and Investment, Joe Sokach, today, there is this Supreme Court legal challenge underway in the US against the tariffs imposed by President Trump. How closely are you watching that, and what are your thoughts on, I guess, the implications for Australian trade, whichever way that falls?
Watching it really closely and working very closely with, of course, our federal counterparts who are the lead on this for us. But when I was in the US just a month ago, when I met with senior government officials in DC, this was a very hot topic of discussion. They couldn't tell me, even from the most progressive to the most conservative side of the DC Hill, what they expected the decision to turn on. What, of course, we want to see is less disruption and less chaos in this trading order and in a really complex world as we see it. There is no doubt that no matter what the Supreme Court in the US decides, the view of the Australian and the South Australian government remains unchanged, and that is that tariffs that are imposed are not good for economies. They're not good for consumers in the home countries. But I think as the US has proven, and this record figure into the US has proven, if you do act early, if you do act decisively, and if you do nuance co-investment and co-design with industry, as our government has, you can soften and mitigate against the large part of that risk.
Minister, before we let you go, earlier this week you also announced this a new direct flights between Adelaide and Shanghai with China Eastern Airlines. How do you see that directly assisting trade into China, which does remain our biggest market?
Look, absolutely. Getting this historic first ever flight from Adelaide to Shanghai, the biggest economy, the biggest financial city in our biggest trading market, is really important for South Australian economic growth. It's also a really key focus of our government to continue to open up Adelaide and South Australia to the world. And the way we do that is to work really closely and collaboratively with industry and the airport to connect Adelaide more closely. But for every one of these flights that connect directly to Adelaide, we see a big boost to tourism, a big boost to trade, and it's all good for local jobs. And, you know, of course, the wonderful new advertising and campaign from the SA Tourism Commission is really going to continue to promote getting those Chinese tourists and tourists from right around the world out into beautiful regional South Australia.
Minister, thanks for your time on the program today.
Thanks, Leah.
Joe Sokach there, Minister for Trade and Investment. It is 13 minutes past 12. You're with Selena Green on the Country Hour. Well, let's stick with trade with China. As a record number of Australian businesses are right now attending the China International Import Expo, showing off some of the best of what we have to offer. Seafood exporter and managing director of Ferguson Australia Group, Andrew Ferguson, is part of this Australian delegation. He stepped out of the expo in Shanghai to speak with Elsie Adamo.
Well, it's a first day today, and the Minister Farrell was here moments ago opening it with a signing ceremony. So this is the first day. This goes through to Monday next week. It's a huge trade show, probably one of the biggest in the world I've ever been to. That many people here, it's incredible. It's just amazing. But all sorts of produce, imports and export product, whatever you can think of, it's here basically. But obviously food halls are fairly large. And so there's certainly a place for, and Australia's got a fairly large stand, a very large stand. I think it's over 1,000 square metres, 180 odd Australians here exhibiting. And we're part of that. Obviously, the states are split up within that group. Yeah, very exciting.
Are you expecting to have much interest in specifically what you're there for, Andrew, which is Australian lobsters?
Yes. No, look, we've already had a lot of interest here. The week before, we'd been to Qingdao. It was a seafood show, their large seafood show. There was an Australian contingent there as well. And that's just purely focuses on seafood. But this is a little bit different, the fact you get a different customer base here. might be hotels, caterers, etc., online sales. So our range of products sort of covers a whole lot of other areas other than just live lobsters. So we're sort of here to expand those markets into these other areas, and particularly the growth of online sales in China in mind is part of our focus.
And as you said, this particular expo has only just started, but with your conversations in the previous week and so far today, do you think there will be that increased demand, that this is a market you'll be able to expand into these new areas?
I think so, given the fact, and then there's plenty of talk in the marketplace about all the tariff situation going on in the world at the moment, and Australia has a free trade with China now since it's reopened, and I think we're in a pretty good position where we sit with the opportunities opening up for us, considering world events going on, and you know, with our relationship now on the mend, it's all sort of helping to line things up, I guess.
So we've spoken often, Andrew, when the ban was on, about the impacts on the industry and what it might look like being back in China. There were a lot of people that were a bit hesitant about how much lobster to send in and if it would be a safe market, but it sounds like it really has bounced back better than expected.
Yes, I think so. I think it's safe to say. But, I mean, obviously, we've not putting all our eggs in one basket anymore either. That's the lessons we've learned. But saying that, the market opening up here is certainly a great benefit to our industry. I mean, the market's not back to exactly where it was 5 or 6 years ago. You know, that's due to the economic events in China as well. But, I mean, we do have a market. That's probably the most important thing. You know, a key market opening up like this is a, you know, really, really, really important thing for us.
Yeah, well, today it was announced as well that China Eastern Airlines will now be flying in and out of Adelaide, servicing a route directly to Shanghai, which is a new route for the state. Is this something you and your business will be able to take advantage of?
Yeah, certainly. I know it's exciting to hear that, and sort of knew it was coming, but it's great to hear it's announced now. You know, I guess from our Southeast factory at Firestar there, we export live lobsters through Melbourne mainly because of the direct flights out of Melbourne, but bringing the opportunity to Adelaide means that, well, for a start, our factory in Adelaide's only 15 minutes from the airport, so that just cuts down on time. The lobsters are out of the water, and of course, they're a perishable product. The longer you can keep them in their tanks, or the longer you can cut down, or shorter you can make that supply chain, the better for the survival rate. So China, there are indirect flights out of Adelaide now by Singapore Airlines, and I think Cathay are opening up as well. But directly from Adelaide to Shanghai, where the biggest market is for our lobsters, particularly the southern rock lobster, our species of lobster, is an amazing opportunity for us anyway. No, we're excited. It's a great move, and I look forward to it.
Are there any particular other Chinese cities you have your eye on, Andrew, that would be good to grow your market in? Any promising cities?
Yeah, look, China Eastern, we work with China Eastern quite closely, and they have great logistics into other cities, and we're just sort of mapping a lot of that out. I think that's certainly the key for us, is to find other smaller markets but have the diversity as well, and maybe helps on, you know, the return for the product with pricing. At the moment, lobsters don't go far beyond the trade routes that have been established up until now, so the opportunity is there to open up more of China. So if we can get lobsters in here quicker, and we can find other trade routes into other parts of China that, you know, don't see so much of our product.
That's the Managing Director of Fergan Australia Group, Andrew Ferguson, speaking with Elsie Adamo. 19 minutes past 12. Well, the Chinese market love our lobster, but could it also now be back in the market for our canola? A shipment of canola bound for China is currently loading at the Port of Esperance in WA's south coast. It's the first time that Australian canola has made its way back into China since 2020, when concerns over the fungal disease blackleg were first flagged. The vessel, Ammonia A, docked in Esperance on Wednesday. It's set to load 65,000 tonnes to take back to Qingdao in northeast China's Shandong province. Pat O'Shaughnessy is the CEO at Grain Trade Australia. He says this trial shipment is a positive sign for the industry.
What we understand is that the Australian government and China authorities have been in sorts of negotiations around canola. And, you know, with that ship appearing on the stem there, it would look that there's been some progress there, I would guess. And what we're hearing is that this is under a trial basis. So what that says to us is that we need to make sure that things are done very well and we don't get too far ahead of ourselves. But if the trial becomes successful, then hopefully that may lead to more market access if you know, it comes to that.
Now, the trade was halted in 2020 due to concerns over the fungal disease blackleg. What's happened since then?
To be honest, that's really a matter for the government. I think that those are the sorts of things that biosecurity and quarantine issues is what the government are responsible for with any country. So, yeah, I'm not too sure on the precise details, but just with that ship appearing on the stem there, you know, you've just got to join the dots, I suppose, and assume that there's been some progress made.
And we're certainly seeing on the MyCor website, which is obviously run by DAF, that there's a raft of new phytosanitary requirements. I suppose that is really a big part of export with any country, but China in particular.
I wouldn't single out China at all, actually. Every country's, and Australia is very particular about its biosecurity requirements for bringing anything into its country, and every country's involved in that discussion. What people don't or should understand is that before we can export any grain to any country anywhere in the world, that there is a process where the two governments need to reach agreement about the biosecurity and quarantine issues around that. So that's really the process that's been going on here as well from what we can see on canola.
Pat, once you lose a trade or a customer or I suppose a country really, how hard is it to get them back?
Negotiation process around biosecurity and quarantine, it doesn't move as fast as technology, for example, these days. So once you do lose access, it is very difficult to get it back. It's important that as an industry and as supply chain operators and as growers that we are conscious of the biosecurity issues, you know, for that reason as well as the other reasons. But yes, it's much easier to keep it than it is to try and get it back.
This is potentially a trial of, well, I suppose different sources have said there may be three trials. Others have said potentially five trials. Who gets involved in a trial like this? Who's involved?
Well, these cargoes, as I said, the government would be involved in the negotiation with the Chinese authorities as to what are those phytosanitary issues and how that's going to work. And then once that's happened, then it's really the role of the commercial operators, the exporters, to execute the shipments in accordance with those requirements.
And we understand that this cargo in particular, owned by CBH Grain, heading to China to a port that's run by COFCO Oils, around 65,000 tonne aboard the Ammonia A, set to sail later this week. Is this a sign that the trade has resumed or will resume, Pat?
Well, as you said, it's from what we understand, it's a trial shipment. So by definition, a trial's a trial. So you need to execute that and then make sure that the requirements that were there under that trial were adhered to and that all sides are comfortable with that. And then it's, again, another matter for the government to continue those negotiations with the other country to work out how to go forward from that point.
Now, Australia hasn't been exporting canola to China for around 5 years now. How important are they really to Australian farmers if that's the case, if we're still being able to export significant amounts without them for the last 5 years?
Having more demand in a market is a good thing for growers. And it's about the aggregate demand that we can build for the commodities is also the important thing. So having more demand for canola is going to be good for canola growers. The China market for Australia in just about any industry that you look at, but in particular for grains, is very important and very long-standing. And so being able to have stronger trade and broader trade, I think, is a good thing, and making sure that the trade relationships remain mutually beneficial, and that as an exporting side of the equation, make sure that we are delivering on the expectations and the requirements of our customers, and that's important no matter where you are. So you know, China, as I said, it's an important market for the Australian grains industry and the oilseeds industry. And if we can get that market access back and that trade flowing again, that'll be significant for both Australia and for China.
Is the industry sort of holding its breath a little here, Pat, while you wait for it to play out and see what happens?
The role of the grain trader is to manage risk. And, you know, this is just another example of risk that's been managed for grain that's going anywhere in the world. So in a sense, holding its breath, but I think in other ways, it's sort of business as usual type of thing. It's what they do every day is manage risk and executing grain into all parts of the world.
When do you expect you'll know if the shipment has been a success and maybe there are, you know, more shipments to come, the trade will resume as normal?
I think that's really a matter for the Australian government and for the Chinese authorities as they sit down and work that through. So it's very difficult to know these things. As we sort of said, these trade and market access issues don't often move very fast. They're quite technical. We'd be foolish to get too far ahead of ourselves. That's the first point. But if we can fulfil the requirements and maintain those relationships with customers, of course it's a good thing for Australian growers. You know, so getting more demand in the market is important, but we should also not lose sight that we need to make sure that this is mutually beneficial for both sides. So we're good for Australian growers and, you know, also good for the canola industry in China in terms of its oil, its protein and the demand for protein in China. And we need to make sure that we keep visibility on both sides of the equation and make sure that we're delivering for customers, because otherwise we're just doing transactions. We're not really developing long-term trade.
Pat O'Shaughnessy there. He is the CEO of Grain Trade Australia and he was speaking to Tara de Langraft. It's 26 minutes past 12.
This is the Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
And it's that time we head to the Weather Bureau for our last cross for the week. We've got senior forecaster Mark Analak. Hi, Mark.
How are you going?
I'm good. What's the weather doing for us today?
Okay, well, over the last sort of 12 hours or so, we have had sort of a trough moving across central parts of the state and a fair bit of high-level cloud drifting across as well, and that's produced a couple of spots of shower activity around the place, but not a huge amount in terms of rainfall. Generally, falls have been less than a few millimetres and mostly confined to agricultural areas and the far west. And I think for the rest of this afternoon, that trough and cold front or trough is sort of hovering over the eastern border districts as we speak, and it's starting to kick up a couple of thunderstorms as well. So for the rest of this afternoon, there is a risk of thunderstorms about eastern border districts, and the risk of severe thunderstorms looks like it's mostly confined to the far northeast corner of the state later this afternoon. So keep an eye out for this later this afternoon. There may be a severe thunderstorm warning for damaging wind gusts in excess of 90 kilometres an hour for the far northern parts of our eastern border districts. But elsewhere, that trough will continue to bring showers and thunderstorms along those eastern border districts. Following in behind that cold front, we're now starting to see a cooler southwest to southerly flow pushing across western and central districts. The trough itself has moved through Oodnadatta. Looks like it's just gone through Lee Creek as well, approaching Yunta, and it hasn't quite made it to sort of the eastern border districts, as I said. So it's through Adelaide, heading a bit north, but the cooler southwesterly winds will continue to push across the state over the coming days. We may see a little bit of increase in shower activity over the next couple of days, but for the most part, there's not too much around. We'll see some light shower activity about southern agricultural areas through tomorrow with a ridge of high pressure sort of pushing in from the west. And the winds turn quite southeasterly very quickly, so it'll be mostly confined to sort of the windward coasts and maybe the southern ranges, but not a huge amount of rainfall expected. By the time we get to sort of Monday, the high pressure system will still be south of Perth and the ridge will still be pushing over South Australia, but there'll be a weak cold front pushing up over southern parts of the state, so an increased risk of shower activity about southern agricultural areas later Monday into Tuesday morning with the passage of that weak system. And then by Tuesday, that high-pressure system finally moves into the Bight, delivering a more stable atmosphere across the state. So we should see a return to mostly fine conditions across South Australia through to the middle part of next week. The only fly in the ointment there is the far northwest corner of the state may see some showers and thunderstorms push down from Western Australia, so they sort of may move into the far northwest corner of the state midweek. But other than that, midweek areas should be fairly fine. In terms of rainfall amounts, we're probably between now and Tuesday, generally less than a couple of millimetres for the pastoral districts and northern agricultural areas, increasing to 2 to 10 millimetres about the west, the southern agricultural area, and we may even see some isolated falls of 5 to 15 millimetres about those windward coasts and ranges.
Thanks, Mark. Have a great rest of your day.
Thank you. See ya.
Mark Analak there, our senior forecaster today at the Weather Bureau. Looking at the western inland parts of New South Wales, for Saturday, mostly sunny in the upper western district with a slight chance of a shower in the northeast and near zero chance elsewhere, and there's a chance of a thunderstorm in the morning and afternoon. South to southwesterly winds 25 to 40 k's an hour, turning west to southwesterlies 25 to 35 k's an hour in the middle of the day before descending south to southwesterly in the evening. Overnight temperatures between 13 and 21, that's big range. Daytime temperatures somewhere between 25 and 35 degrees. For the lower western district, partly cloudy with a chance of a thunderstorm in the northeast in the early morning. Winds will be southwesterly, 25 to 40 k's an hour. Overnight temperatures between 10 and 15 degrees. During the day, they should reach somewhere between 21 and 26 degrees. It's 29 minutes to 1.
You're listening to Selena Green on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Well, coming up, some good news for one part of the state that after years has finally been declared free of fruit fly. How long until the others follow suit? Also, are we any closer to having a herpes virus released to try and wipe out the carp that's infesting our waterways?
It's really critical for those decision makers that make the decision about bringing a new organism into the country and release it into the environment to make sure that it is safe and effective.
That and a lot more coming up, and hopefully I'll get to play another one of your Harvest 100 top 10 picks after we get some news headlines from Matt Coleman. Hi, Matt.
Hello, Selena. In the news this afternoon, the state government says that exports from SA to the United States have hit an all-time high. It says the latest from the Bureau of Statistics revealed sales to the US are up more than 16% on last year. The Trade Minister, Joe Sockarch, says a diverse range of products, including meat and wine, have performed strongly. The state government is looking to implement a minimum height limit for buildings on some parts of West Terrace in Adelaide CBD. Last week, changes were proposed to raise height restrictions in the city, which would allow developments on West Terrace to get pre-approval for up to 20 stories. And Tesla shareholders have approved a record-breaking pay package for boss Elon Musk that could be worth more than $1 trillion. The unprecedented deal, recommended by the company's board, has been approved by 75% of Tesla shareholders at its annual general meeting in Texas. More news at 1 o'clock.
Thank you, ma'am. Still trying to wrap my head around the concept of having $1 trillion. It would be a great shopping spree, but it's a bit too much of a bigger figure to wrap my head around. I don't know about you. Well, some good news today for Swan Reach, because it's become the first town to be declared fruit fly free since the outbreak started in the Riverland almost 5 years ago. The area's had no detections of Queensland fruit fly since February 2023. But PIRZA says it'll continue to monitor to ensure it remains free of the pest moving forward. Now, the Minister for Primary Industries, Claire Scriven, says it's a positive development for the state's eradication efforts.
So it's really good news for Swan Reach, but also for the Riverland more generally, because it shows that, you know, with the sort of strong community cooperation that we've seen and a lot of persistence, that we can eradicate fruit fly. And that, of course, is so important in protecting our growers, our markets and our livelihoods. So Swan Reach is the first one to be so declared, and that's really good news.
How long was Swan Reach a fruit fly outbreak area that was under restrictions?
So there's been a number of restrictions since the outbreak began in December 2020. With the Swan Reach area, they haven't actually had a detection of Queensland fruit fly since February 2023, so quite some time. But because of the way that the international protocols work, because of the pest-free area and the arrangements that have been put in place, it until now has had to be still part of that overall outbreak area and therefore have the same restrictions. But now we have been able to make that declaration. It's been, if you like, sort of separated, decoupled is the term, from the other areas of the Riverland that still have fruit fly. And so that's a really positive outcome for that particular region.
What does the fruit fly free declaration mean for growers in that area, but also for the community of Swan Reach?
So there's a few different things. Obviously, if you're a grower, that's going to be different to the arrangements if you're, you know, a citizen. So because the quarantine restrictions remain in place across the other outbreaks across the Riverland, and because it's still part of the pest-free area, there'll still be restrictions on bringing host fruit and vegetables into the region. So that's an important piece to know. But for growers, it does mean that they don't need to go through the same sorts of processes that they've had to in the past. But what I would encourage people to do is to still look at the fruitfly.sa.gov.au website. That gives all of the information that they need, whether they're, you know, an individual who's travelling, a resident, whatever it might be, and that's the best way to stay up to date.
And how many fruit fly outbreak areas remain for the Riverland?
So there are still 56 Riverland outbreaks, and there's quarantine restrictions in place for those. But in the same way that Swan Reach hadn't actually had a detection for quite some time, there's quite a lot of areas that are considered outbreak areas, but that don't necessarily have detections for some time. It's quite a complicated arrangement in terms of the international protocols for trade. So that's been really difficult, I think, for the local community and also for local growers. But it is really, you know, promising that we have got to the stage where one of the regions now has been able to be declared free of fruit fly, and we continue to work and treat and have the other protections in place for those remaining outbreaks.
If there are no further detections in those 56 remaining outbreak areas, when are they expected to end?
So if there were no more detections, then I think it's the 20th of January next year that that could be declared as free from fruit fly. Now, we know that there are, you know, still detections happening, and there are some areas that are more difficult than others. And that's why I really do encourage the community to stay vigilant, take some comfort, I guess, from the fact that Swan Reach has now been declared free of fruit fly. And if we keep on going with that same level of diligence, then we should be able to get to the same situation with those other outbreak areas.
And how confident are you that other fruit fly outbreak areas will be declared free from the pest, given they've been under restrictions for almost 5 years now?
Yeah, so we've done a lot of work in terms of addressing the fruit fly issue. We've invested in expanding the sterile insect technology facility. So that's what we call sit flies. So they are the sterile insects which are being dropped over the Riverland. And that's going a long way, I think, to helping with this situation. But it is so important. Every backyard, every orchard, every area that could have host fruit or vegetables is really important to be continuing to be vigilant.
How much has the state government spent so far since the first outbreak was detected in the Riverland in December 2020?
Look, I'd have to check that exact figure. I know at one stage we were talking about the fact that we'd spent more than $90 million. I'm not sure what the up-to-date figure would be, but that certainly does give some level of insight into how seriously we've taken this and how much we've been willing to invest to try to support the Riverland communities and support the growers in that region.
Primary Industries Minister Claire Scriven speaking with Jess Schremer. Other fruit fly restrictions of the 56 outbreaks, they remain in place until January next year, but all those details are on PERS's website. It is 22 minutes to one. Well, more research still needs to be done before a carp herpes virus can be released. That's the conclusion from a Department of Agriculture, Fisheries and Forestry update on the carp biological control program. Impact on other species, water quality and modes of transmission between the fish are some of the main research focuses that remain. The department's Chief Environmental Biosecurity Officer, Dr. Bertie Henneke, says the population of carp in the river continues to cause damage, although it fluctuates between the seasons.
In an average year, we have a population of up to 2 million carps in the system, and in a wet year, it's even more. It's up to, you know, can be over 350 million tonnes. But as again, as I said, that depends on the year. It can fluctuate, but at the end of the day, carp is a significant problem.
Listening to you talk about it earlier today, the body of work and the hurdles that you've established that you need to get across before this thing can go ahead are enormous. Are they achievable?
They are, Timo, and a lot of the work has been done previously by the FRDC, the Fisheries Research and Development Corporation, under their development to produce a national carb control plan. That was intensive research over a period of 6 years, from 2016 to 2022, and that work is published, and there's a lot of research and information in that will help us to understand how the virus might work, what impact it has on other species than carp. So all that work is there, but they were highlighting in the report that there's still some remaining work that needs to be done in terms of the whole specificity and some of the impact the carp would have. That's just some minor, some sort of work that still is currently underway, and hopefully that will provide us all the answers that we need to provide our regulatory approval agencies with the confidence that the carp virus can be released and it's safe and effective to do that. But again, that work has to be done to really get that final approval from the regulatory approval agencies.
It's been such a hot topic. We were talking about it before and talked about it for so long, and I think people have heard we just need to do more research has been the consistent finding since 2018. Whereabouts are we in terms of the timeline?
Yeah, the timeline is always an interesting one, and at the moment the timeline for this particular research is that we're anticipating or to have all that information by 2028, so that's still another 2.5 years to go. But again, it's really critical for those decision makers that make the decision about bringing a new organism into the country and release it into the environment, to make sure that that is safe and effective and it doesn't have any impact on human health or our environment in the broader sense. I guess if people need information, they can go to our website, which is on the department's website. If they just put CARP biocontrol program into their Google, that will get it to them. That provides all the information, you know, that we talked about today at the webinar too. So that's maybe something that is worthwhile mentioning.
Dr. Bertie Henneke there, speaking with Timu King. Dr. Bertie is the Chief Environmental Biosecurity Officer with the Environment Department.
This week on Landline, the menace of feral pigs.
They can take your potential production and halve it. Pigs can do a lot of damage, and they do a lot of damage to country.
That's Landline, Sunday 12:30 on ABC TV and iView.
You're with Selena Green today. Well, earlier this week we had the top 10 of the hottest 100 revealed by Grain Producers South Australia, and the full 100 playlist, well, actually 300 songs that you all voted for, is up on their Spotify account now. I played you the number one song for 2025 as voted by Grain Producers. If you missed it, that was Working Class Man by Jimmy Barnes. Well, since it's Friday, let's have a bit of fun. Play one of the other top songs that you voted for. This one came in behind it at number two, one of the more modern songs that made the top 10 of the playlist, Luke Combs and When It Rains, It Pours.
Sunday morning, man, she woke up fighting mad, bitching and moaning on and on about the time I had. And by Tuesday, you could say that girl was good as gone. All alone, so I went for a drive to clear my mind. Ended up at a Shell on I-65. Then I won $100 on a scratch-off ticket, bought 2 12-packs and a tank of gas with it. She swore they were a waste of time, all, but she was wrong. Deep sea senorita fishing down in Panama. And I ain't gotta see my ex-future mother-in-law anymore. Oh Lord, when it rains, it pours. Now she was sure real quick to up and apologize.
when she heard about my newfound luck on that FM dial. And it's crazy how lately now it just seems to come in waves. What I thought was gonna be the death of me was my saving grace. It's got me thinking that her leaving is the only logical reason that I got the last spot in the Hooters parking lot, and the waitress left her number on my check with a heart. She picked up on the first ring when I gave her a call, and I only spent $5 at the Moose Club raffle, what a used four wheeler and three free passes for me and two of my buddies to play around a golf. And I ain't gotta see my ex-future mother-in-law anymore. Oh Lord, when it rains, it pours. When it rains, it pours. I've been on one hell of a redneck road for 3 weeks now, and it all started on the day that she walked out. Then I won $100 on a scratch-off ticket, bought 2 12-packs and a tank of gas with it. She swore they were a waste of time all, but she was wrong. And I was caller number 5 on the radio station, won a 4-day, 3-night beach vacation. Deep sea senorita fishing down in Panama. See my ex-future mother-in-law anymore. Oh Lord, when it rains, it pours. When it rains, it pours.
Luke Combs and When It Rains, It Pours, your number 2 song in the Harvest 100 for 2025.
This is the Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
You're with Selena Green on this Friday. Now, it's been a couple of decades since a bunch of vegetable growers led one of Australia's biggest tractor-powered agricultural protests to Canberra. For many, it's a case of deja vu. Farmers are once again feeling the pressure from an influx of cheap imported product. So can the federal government's latest Buy Australia campaign reignite a movement they started 20 years ago? Larissa Smith has the story.
And I have a look at this home brand, and I have a look, and I see straight cut chips, and they're from Belgium. And I look at peas, and they're from New Zealand. And I look at beans, and they're from China. And I look at sweet corn, and it's from the USA.
Shame.
Whose bloody home's that? It's certainly not ours.
This sounds like it could be a farmer protest anywhere in Australia, but it was actually 20 years ago. On the stage, you can hear Tasmanian vegetable grower and former Woolworths distribution manager Richard Bovell. In 2005, farmers were angry at fast food chain McDonald's for cutting French fry contracts worth $10 million and importing product from New Zealand. They asked Richard Bovell to help them do something about it.
And at that point in time, there was a general concern about the processing vegetable industry in Tasmania and food processing in Australia in general. And they were worried about their future. A lot of them had big debts on farms they'd taken over from their family. And if you start to lose all the means by which you're going to repay that debt, it becomes a problem. And we had to try and invent a tool to get a message out to the Australian public, because it's only Australian consumers by their behaviour that can make these industries stay in Australia and exist. If they're not buying Australian product, ultimately these factories will disappear, and when they're gone for good.
It took some years, but there was an eventual overhaul of country of origin labelling, showing not just where the product was packed, but grown as well. Richard Bovell admits that was a big win for the industry.
As a result of that campaign, the fact that we had both Coles and Woolworths coming out with their Australian branded product very clearly, it gave consumers the opportunity to buy it, and for a period of time they voted with their feet, and there was a significant improvement in sales, and at that stage Simplot acknowledged that they were getting an uplift in sales as a result of that.
But processed vegetable imports have crept back onto shelves. Supermarkets are stocking more of their own brands. Louise Grimmer is an associate professor in marketing at the University of Tasmania.
They've changed them at an incredible rate, so they're actually investing millions of dollars into private label or home brand products. But it does pay to look on the back of packaging to see where your product was actually originated or grown, and where it might have been produced or you know, put together to become the final product. A lot of the time we think that especially frozen food is made in Australia, but what we're discovering is more and more a lot of these products are coming from overseas.
We asked both Woolworths and Coles what percentage of their private label products across their multiple brands for frozen and canned vegetables were Australian. Woolworths says the majority of its frozen vegetables own brand range is locally sourced and has been for some time, while its tinned vegetables are sourced globally, it says, to help meet customer demand. For frozen and canned vegetables, Coles says it works with a mix of Australian and international suppliers to ensure consistent year-round availability, adding that geographic diversification helps protect customers from seasonal weather impacts and other supply chain disruptions. But the rise in private label offerings by the major supermarkets hasn't gone unnoticed in vegetable growing districts.
All of a sudden, we seem to see that same symptoms again are happening in this region, with contraction in the throughput of the factories that do process vegetables here.
That's potato grower Matt Ryan. He was also heavily involved in the Fair Dinkum food campaign back in 2005.
Last vegetable processing plant left in Australia, frozen vegetable plant left in Australia, is here in Devonport, just a few k's away from here. So it's about creating another public debate, and it's about engaging with the politicians and the people that do make decisions, and putting our hand up and holding those retailers to account and say, hey, it's not okay. You know, you want to make profits in Australia and you want to make profits in the community. How about supporting the industries that the communities rely on here? It's a sovereign risk issue, to be honest.
We need to have capacity in Australia to manufacture a range of different goods, but we've also got to look at the fact that we've got to be competitive in doing it. Nobody's going to buy their stuff if it's overpriced. We have to look at the cost of doing business. I think we need the government to have some very strong incentives for businesses to invest in systems that make them as efficiently as they possibly can. And in some cases, that actually means getting rid of labour out of the workforce. We're competing against factories in some countries that are almost dark factories. They employ, even in China, there's a lot of the modern manufacturing now doesn't employ anybody. That's our competition. If you're going to be in the game, you've got to have a level playing field.
As former Tassie vegetable grower and farmer advocate Richard Bovell, ending that report from Larissa Smith on the 20-year anniversary of the Fair Dinkum food campaign. And you can catch that story on the most recent episode of Landline on iView. It's 7 minutes to one. Well, finally today, you might have heard about tewa in wine, but what about in extra virgin olive oil? Well, soil health, plant health, monitoring the olive growth process, these are all components influencing the flavour that you end up with in the finished bottle. Someone who knows a lot about that is Murraylands producer Rio Vista Olives, which has just taken out multiple wins in the Australian International Olive Awards for their single variety olives. Well, the sales and marketing manager, Sarah Asciuto, explains what it means for the family operation in times of drought to be awarded these prizes.
It's an amazing thing, really. I think when you're a small grower and you're working tirelessly all year with the elements and all the fun that comes along with farming. So when you know that your team has worked so hard, and everyone's got involved from the level of the soil to the trees and then to the end result, to then take out something like Best in Show really is just a testament to everyone's hard work and just makes everyone feel so proud of what they've been able to achieve.
Some of the wins were for your single variety olive oils. What are some of the considerations that go into growing those, and what role does terroir play?
Well, terroir is a very important element when it comes to a single variety. We've got between our groves in different soils that may be even within the same grove, different varieties respond differently to different soil types. So the flavour profiles, the intensity, even the antioxidant level can change a lot between varietal and between the soil that it's grown in, and even just its growing conditions.
So I'm imagining there goes a lot of work into looking after the soil health and the plant health for all those different varieties.
Definitely. We've got an agronomist that actually works with us and that specialises in olives. And so he has been absolutely amazing with his knowledge and his know-how, and just every day they're in that grove, checking the soils, making sure the nutrients are right, making sure the trees are healthy, try and get the best out of each tree.
How many single varieties do you currently grow, and what are some of those?
So we have about 18 varietal that we grow within our groves. So the one that took out Best in Show was an Italian variety called Signore, which is more that grassy style, green, herbaceous type oil. We also grow varieties like Calamata, Coronecchi, Manzanillo, Nevadillo, Frantoio, Corrigiola. So there's quite a variety of different olives that we grow, and each one has its own little personality.
And what were some of the comments from the judges for those oils that took out the wins?
So for the Signore, a lot of the tasting notes they found was that it had a lot of green banana, tropical fruits, fresh cut grass, herbs and spices. The important remark for us is always that it's a balanced, complex, persistent oil. So for the Signore, it ticked all the boxes with that. It was classed as harmonious and delicious. And then for some of our champion Coronecchi and Calamata varieties, they had more different notes of herbs, rocket, tomato, banana, and they like to talk about the length of the oil, that they're complex and long and pungent, everything you sort of look for in a really good extra virgin olive oil.
How challenging was it producing those oils given the drought in South Australia?
Drought is always a bit of a burden on everyone in farming. We had to struggle a lot with making sure the trees were still getting enough water. I mean, we're fortunate with having the agronomist that he's conscious of the soil health, so we can try and not have to use so much water that we add in because the soil can retain its own, but it always affects how much growth we get with a tree. And not only can it affect this year's crop, it can also affect the following year's crop because the trees aren't always getting their nutrients. So we know, like for a lot of other growers, it's been a real struggle of a couple years now of drought. It's really affected everyone's product, but we've been fortunate that we've tried really hard just with our soil and tree health to be able to negate as much as we can of those effects.
How much do you currently produce, and are all your groves based in South Australia?
Yes, so we're 100% South Australian. We've got a couple groves in Maipalonga near Murray Bridge in the Murraylands. And then we've also got a grove in Mount Torrens in the Adelaide Hills. And so between those groves, we've got about 41 hectares of olives that we look after and grow, and that's what we produce from.
And it's a family operation. How many generations has it been, and are there any plans to further expand?
So it involves my dad, my brothers, myself, my nephew as well was now also involved. So that's three generations. And it actually started with my husband's grandfather, this love of extra virgin olive oil. So even though he didn't have a grove, he was the one that actually inspired us to get involved. For us, expansion is probably more about growth, in the sense of we're constantly trying to create the best extra virgin olive oil we can, with the highest quality, the amount of polyphenols, the taste profiles. So that is something that we're always striving to make sure that we're maintaining and growing further with our oils.
That is Rio Vista Olives Sales and Marketing Manager Sarah Asciuto speaking with Jessica Schremer about their multiple wins in the Australian International Olive Awards.
Always great to celebrate a local success story. That's all we've got time for today and for this week on The Country Hour. Selena Green with you today, and I'll be back with you on Monday at noon to bring you another week of The Country Hour. If you've missed anything this week and you'd like to listen back, you can find us on the ABC Listen app or head to our website. If you just put South Australian Country Hour into your search engine, you'll find our webpage there and all of our episodes for you to go back through. And plenty of reading on abc.net.au/rural. That should keep you busy throughout the next few days. Thanks for your company. Have a safe and happy afternoon. I'll catch you next week. It's coming up to 1 o'clock and time for the news.
Don't fight the static. Hear ABC local radio crystal clear on the ABC Listen app. Download now.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.